To start our show here today, uncertainty continues to surround tens of thousands of Central American refugees seeking asylum in the United States. Federal officials, including the President and Congress, along with the states, are grappling with how to respond to about 57,000 people, many of them children, who have arrived at the U.S. border since last October. The refugees are mainly fleeing drug and gang violence. As Governor Rick Snyder acknowledged recently, some of these refugees already have been transferred to Michigan. More may be coming as some in the state voice support on humanitarian grounds. The refugees' futures will largely be determined after U.S. courts define their legal status. But what laws, statutes, and other considerations will go into that process? To try to answer that question, we're joined by Jason Eister. Mr. Eister is the director of the Department of Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy at Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Ann Arbor, where he is also an associate professor. Jason Eister, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be here.
Before you help us understand this process, tell us just a bit more about your background as an attorney who has been involved in immigration cases.
I've been practicing immigration law for a number of years, and for nearly 10 years I've been assisting unaccompanied immigrant children and other vulnerable immigrants in navigating the complex legal system and trying to help determine their right to continued presence here in the United States. And currently, as you said, I do run the Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy Clinic at Cooley Law School, where I trained students to go up and stand before the immigration judge and both take testimony and also advocate on behalf of our clients.
The ultimate aim of our legal system here is to determine the legal status of each of these asylum seekers. Do our laws require that?
Well, Mark, under the U.S. Constitution, the Congress, of course, is given the right to make the laws governing immigration, and then they give those laws over to the president, and he's given the responsibility to execute those laws through regulations and operational directives, creating the vast number of departments and agencies that oversee this. So, indeed, the laws do require that each individual who is coming to the United States, everyone who's immigrating, we do have to determine what their legal rights are.
Walk us through what's in play then as far as existing laws and treaties and what our responsibilities are according to those laws and treaties. Help us understand a few of the big pieces in play here, please.
Sure. You'd already mentioned asylum seekers. These children are being screened for a number of different qualifications that they may have and which would allow them to remain in the United States. And the first one is asylum. Asylum is granted to an individual who flees their country and has a well-founded fear of return to that country based on a fear of persecution on account of their religious beliefs, their political views, membership in a particular social group, their ethnicity or their nationality. In addition to that, the United States has also signed a treaty called the Torture Convention in which the United States refuses to return individuals who would face torture from their government. Third, the United States has created something called special immigrant juvenile status, where a child is here in the United States and has been abandoned, abused, or neglected by his or her family. He or she has the right to remain here. And then finally, if the child is the victim of a severe form of trafficking, the child has the right as well to remain here.
So there are a number of...
One area that they do not have the right for, we do have something right now which is called Deferred Action for Child Arrivals. A child who has been in this country since 2007, who has gone to school here or been in the armed forces, that child has the right to remain here under prosecutorial discretion. None of these children would have that qualification.
Now, I take it each refugee's case will be reviewed individually?
That's right. They're reviewed individually and at different points depending on what claims arise. When these children first arrive, and at the present time, some of the children are indeed entering the United States and trying to get up to to other areas. Others are apparently running to the Border Patrol agents that they see and grabbing them around the leg and saying, you know, here I am, I want help. The Border Patrol is our first line along the border, and those agents, it's their responsibility to make a determination, is this child an unaccompanied immigrant child? That's the first decision that's made, and certain decisions are made based on that. If the child is from Mexico or Canada, then within the first 48-hour period, that child will either be given the opportunity to voluntarily return to the country or will be placed in the jurisdiction and the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. However, if they're from Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, or any of the other non-contiguous countries, then they are, if they are determined to be unaccompanied, they are automatically placed with the Office of Refugee Resettlement. From there, the process will continue with determinations being made about whether or not they seem to have qualifications for these different protections that I mentioned, and those will be decided either by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service initially with regard to their asylum application or their special immigrant juvenile status. In other cases, they will be going before an immigration judge.
Jason Eister is our guest. He is the director of the Department of Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy at Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Ann Arbor. How vigorously would the court investigate a refugee's claims?
Sure. The burden is always, the burden is on the applicant to get any immigration rights. And therefore, while the courts will investigate, it is up to the applicant to provide the corroborating evidence to show that, that one does qualify. And therefore, that brings about the real need for qualified and vigorous advocacy on behalf of these children. It is the first part, for example, of the special immigrant juvenile status is an application is made to a local family court or juvenile court. And there the judge will take testimony, will accept evidence, and make a determination, was this child abused, abandoned, or neglected? The burden is, again, is on the child. In each of these cases, the burden is on this applicant. So the courts will investigate, but investigation is not their key responsibility. It is the responsibility of the applicant to prove that, that the individual is fleeing persecution in each of these other categories.
Well, with so many unaccompanied kids, though, will a lot of these kids, it will fall to the kids themselves to essentially make their case. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. There is a directive from in one of the laws that was passed by Congress that to the extent possible, the Department of Health and Human Services will seek to have representation for every child, and that typically is pro bono, unpaid for representation. The challenge, of course, is the numbers have increased so dramatically with this surge that there is a challenge in identifying those individuals. I must say, however, that the American Immigration Lawyers Association has been responding to volunteer attorneys who are members of that organization or trained immigration attorneys who've said that they will get on the plane and fly down to Texas or wherever it may be and assist in representation. The real challenge is that one cannot just walk into the court and start representing. There is a sophisticated amount of fact gathering, of evidentiary gathering that's necessary in order to make a strong case for these children, in order to understand what the truth is, and that takes time.
I did read a report. Well, one other question. Jason, does an individual immigration judge finally determine legal status?
In many of these cases, that is correct. The decisions are made by an immigration judge sitting in the location where the child is residing, or as we're doing more and more now, by video conference from an immigration judge. And one of President Obama's moves was to create more immigration judges to deal with this right now and also to increase the amount of video conferencing that would be available to assist in more rapidly determining these cases. Right now, it's determined by the by Congress that it's perhaps taking, I think, 587 days to adjudicate these cases in immigration court. Then that's not just the children's cases, but all cases. There's a severe backlog right now, a shortage of judges. In Michigan, for example, we previously had 4 immigration judges, and now we're down to 2, and we're trying to take care of that through some video conferencing with judges down in Puerto Rico. But there is a real slowdown in our ability to process cases as they exist now, and so this growing influx also creates a growing demand.
I did read a report a couple days ago saying that roughly 3/4 of these asylum seekers are fleeing drug and gang violence, about 75%. Does that suggest to you that the U.S. could likely justify granting refugee status to about 3/4 of these people?
Gang membership and the threat from these gangs and from drug cartels has not historically been well received by the immigration judges. That has been changing, and so it's hard to say whether or not all of these children would receive asylum. They have to show that they are a member of a particular social group that's recognizable, that it does fear persecution. If these children were returned to these countries, would they be persecuted on account of certain beliefs, certain attitudes they have? So not all of that, not the entire 3/4. Another law that does come into play, though, however, is the Torture Convention. And there have been immigration judges who have ruled that certain children, abandoned street children, individuals who are fleeing gang membership, that they do qualify based on the Torture Convention, primarily because of the lack of police protection, but also because of the involvement of the police. Just last month, the U.S. State Department released a travel advisory in which they stated that the National Police Force of Honduras had members who were involved in murder and other crimes, and they said that the criminal elements have impunity throughout much of the country, and therefore they were suggesting that U.S. citizens maybe not visit or be more careful, but it does also lay a pretty strong groundwork to say that these children could face torture should they be returned, either through the police or through organizations that the police are unable or unwilling to control.
There is we've got less than a minute, Jason. I want to get working one more question. There is a funding issue in play here, too, which you alluded to a minute ago. Last month, President Obama requested $3.7 billion in part to get more judges to the southern U.S. to start this process. The Congress is considering much less. Do you understand the role additional funding plays in this?
Well, this certainly is a funding question, because you have coming to the fore two different issues. One, that these children need protection until their cases are determined, and secondly, that the cases do have to be decided. We don't have enough judges to make the decisions, and we don't have enough places for individuals to stay for extensive periods of time. And both of those require more funding.
Jason Eyster is the director of the Department of Immigrant Rights and Civil Advocacy at Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Ann Arbor. We appreciate your being with us today, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.